You're listening to The Fifth Estate, a podcast from the Wheeler Centre. This week, our topic is the 2019 Australian federal election, slated for the next couple of months. To help us think through the issues and the politics, we're joined by Michelle Grattan and John Hewson. Our host is broadcaster and anthropologist Sally Warhaft,
and it's just a pleasure to have you all here tonight. I am somebody who just loves elections. I'm somebody that throughout my entire life, I just prayed that they would never introduce four yearly elections. I'm somebody who on election day waits until the time that I think the queue will be longest. And I stand there with my democracy sausage, pondering what the evening may bring. I am somewhat over that vibe at the moment as we prepare for an election that I've heard the Sofitel in Sydney is booked for the 11th and the 18th of May, and which is, you know, I don't know if that's the wisest spending of donor money by the Liberal Party, but or even in fact if it's true, but we will see. Anyway, for all those reasons, it is such a pleasure and more to invite and welcome our guests this evening. Michelle Grattan, of course, she's been in the press gallery for more than 40 years. She's worked for the Australian Financial Review, the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age. She was the first female editor of an Australian daily. She's currently associate editor of politics and the chief political correspondent at The Conversation and an officer of the Order of Australia, and a very, very welcome return guest here, Michelle Grattan. And also welcoming back another great friend of the Fifth Estate, John Hewson, who, of course, is a former leader of the Liberal Party, former member for Wentworth. John retired from politics in 1995 and now works in academia, in business, in government, particularly in his area of expertise in economics and the financial system, but also a well-known commentator across all the mediums, including virtual. Welcome, John Hewson.
Thank you.
I was thinking about where we begin with this discussion, and I decided to begin with the thing that's most on my mind in our politics at the moment, and that is the division in the government. And I wondered if you could each start by speaking to that and your sense of it and what it means for the coming election. And Michelle, we'll start with you.
Well, I think that this has been a defining feature of this last term of the government, and indeed the term before, but particularly in this last term. And it is primarily an ideological division. There's no doubt that the Conservatives in the Liberal Party have made it their business to try to grab control of the party, to set the agenda, to set the bounds of the party. Now, people talk about the broad church, but I think a section of that church has become very dominant and power-hungry, has seen the opportunity to have a takeover and has seized it. Of course, the overthrow of Malcolm Turnbull was a sign of this, a culmination of this, if you like, although there was a lot of revenge politics in that as well. So those divisions have really stymied the government, I think, in this term. And in a way, Scott Morrison, since he became Prime Minister, has attempted to sort of somehow walk a line on top of or between these rifts, and he's the ultimate pragmatist. He's not an ideologue, but I think he has found it very difficult to navigate that course, and he from time to time is trying to keep one side happy, keep the other side happy, pick up strands of public opinion and respond to them. Of course, he is, unlike the previous leaders, he's quite safe because he couldn't have been overthrown in the short time that he was leader, or he has been leader. But I think this question of ideology is central to the Liberal Party at the moment.
That conservative flank, John, it feels sometimes like they'd rather throw the election than lose to within their own party forces. You were the leader of that broad church. Has it changed?
Well, I think most people would be surprised that they've learnt nothing from the past. I mean, when I first got active in the party in the late 80s, we had the Howard versus Peacock era. Peacock pulled the coup in 89, went to an election in 1990. Both sides of politics polled that, and the message was pretty clear: if you can't govern yourselves, you can't govern the country. Disunity is death. Hawke picked that up and ran that as the theme in the 1990 campaign. The Liberal Party organisation decided that that wasn't worth running, or couldn't be run, or shouldn't be addressed, so they came up with the slogan, "Andrew is the answer," which only lasted a little while, because people figured he wasn't. But, you know, having seen that unfold since then, you'd think they would have learned. And I'm slightly different in my assessment of what's happened recently. It's easy to say it's ideological, but they're not consistently conservative. I mean, if you were genuinely a conservative who believed in small government, you believed in low levels of regulation, believed in market forces, then you'd respond to climate by putting a price on carbon. And they've had that position several times in the last 20 years, but they've never done it. So I think it's more the recent events were really just Abbott getting even with Turnbull, conned Dutton into believing he could be Prime Minister, put him up as a bit of a straw man, ran hard against it, undermined. Yes, to answer your question, some in the party would be happy to say, OK, if it costs us the election, at least we've cleaned the place out. But that's very short-sighted and very counterproductive, and I think it will impact on their standing in this election for sure.
Can I just add one Please. Point to that? I take the point about the terminology conservative. One should say the right, I think, rather than conservative is a sort of confusing term which includes various other strands, but the right, I think, has been determined to get things.
Is that different to, say, John Howard's era, where it was a conservative wing and a more liberal wing, where now it is the right? Is it something different?
I think that the right has hardened. I think in John Howard's time it was more pragmatic than those trying to drive the agenda and seize the party, and that is a difference. And also I think that the moderates were more assertive than they've been in recent times. Now, moderates, of course, were quite high in the government, Bishop, Pine, so on, but they really didn't stand up strongly for moderate values, and the moderates on the backbench were again, more assertive in Howard's time, for example, over refugees than they've been in this government.
Yeah, I think Howard said, of course, that he governed with a broad church, but he actually governed to the right-hand side of the pulpit. He didn't give the left-hand side a lot of influence. I mean, he was more pragmatic, as Michelle has said, but he you know, he ostracised people like Bruce Baird, who'd been a very successful minister in New South Wales government, John Fay, Petro Giorgio, and a number of others. On occasions, he'd put a progressive into a key position, but he got away with it. I think probably as issues broke and, you know, border security became an issue, the progressives were silenced to some extent than they might otherwise have been. And I agree that in more recent times, they haven't been that assertive. I would have thought that when Malcolm came in, the expectation was that he really did believe in doing something substantive about climate change. It was a reason why he lost the election the first time around, lost the leadership the first time around. But when he didn't deliver, you know, and those around him didn't see any leadership on those progressive issues, then I think it was, as you say, they're a lot quieter this time around than they were in the past.
Governments usually campaign on their achievements and they fall very flat when they can't, whether, you know, it's Al Gore refusing to talk about Bill Clinton or also Kevin Rudd II not being able to run on the achievements after the Rudd-Gillard ousting chaos. I was reflecting on what achievements this government will be able to run on. The three that came to mind were marriage equality and two royal commissions, of which these were all things that in fact the government resisted but happened in their time. What are the achievements I'm forgetting?
I don't think you are forgetting any great achievements. If the government were here, it would say economic management, and it'll be running substantively on that in the campaign to come. But I think that these days the community expects governments to manage the economy, and so I don't think it will get a lot of credit on that, and I don't think it's done anything spectacular. If you look back on the Howard government, for example, admittedly there a longer time, but I think John Howard can say gun control was a big achievement. Looks sort of easy in retrospect, but very difficult at the time. And reform of the tax system to a fair extent with the GST, modified, but nevertheless got in. So those were substantive achievements. I don't think that this government can really point to anything big that it's done except the marriage equality change, which, as you say, was really forced on it, and was a time when we saw several moderates push the government into doing it. We did see the moderates take some action on that instance, but not much else.
Look, there's no doubt they will run hard on the economy, but I think their economic narrative does not resonate with the great majority of Australians these days. I mean, they'll comment on how growth has been strong or 28 years without a recession. Employment numbers have been quite good, and ignore the fact that the average family, the average household is struggling to meet the cost of living. And some of their arguments are getting quite ridiculous. Frydenberg recently came out and said that the fact that our savings rate had fallen to pre-GFC levels was an indication of how confident consumers were. Well, that... You know, they've been struggling to make ends meet. They've run down their savings. They've run up our debt. Household debt is near the highest in the world, 120% of GDP, nearly 200% of disposable income, at a time when house prices are falling, wages are flat, and people are struggling. So to run the narrative along the lines that they've been and then try to argue that, of course, a switch to Labor will be you'll risk a recession, you'll risk, you know, they're risking a recession right now because the world is slowing down. Our export commodities are going to be in much less demand, and it doesn't take too much in a global circumstance to actually disrupt that economic outlook. So it's a very precarious set of circumstances, and to be running an argument that doesn't resonate, I think will not help them at all this time.
The campaign year began with the, you know, it's like a sort of well-worn mantra now, isn't it, with the coalition, that it's the economy and security and immigration. Sometimes I think there's a feeling there when there might be a turn, when things change, and along with that feeling comes a bit of bad luck in timing. We saw so much of it in John Howard's last election campaign, and I sort of, the economic messages and figures of, you know, they haven't been great. But now, of course, on immigration and security too, there's been a terrible turn with what happened in Christchurch, and a change in message, it seemed to me, from the Prime Minister in the past few days on that. Have you noticed that change, Michelle? And do you think it's going to alter their strategy for this campaign?
Well, he gave a major speech this week saying that tribalism, a retreat to tribalism was a real threat to our society, and it encouraged extremism, and it should not be allowed to corrupt the debate around issues like immigration, border security and so on. But the problem with this is that the government itself has ramped up the tribalism, if you like, the really harsh messaging. And more widely, of course, I think politicians generally have, by their behaviour and their casting of debates in very aggressive, personalised terms, they've just further alienated the community in terms of trust. Now, we know that trust has been declining probably since the 70s, certainly in the last 20 years, trust in the political system, trust in politicians. And I think that this is a really central issue for our democracy. And, of course, the whole debate about extremism is a sort of sub-theme, if you like, of that wider trust issue. But it is a really important one, and I don't think politicians can suddenly, you know, just change the language in a speech or two and expect the community to say, oh, well, that's all fine now, you're not behaving like you were. That's, I mean, people remember how they behaved before.
That's what reminds me of John Howard when, you know, in the very last sort of moments he became a believer in climate change. And
but look what happened to him.
That's right, yeah.
It didn't wash. The community did not accept it. Now, on the climate change issue, it's quite interesting. Scott Morrison, of course, announced a package two or three weeks ago on this, and many people saw that as a change. I must say, in that case, I saw that really just as a continuation of what had gone before. For example, Tony Abbott's Direct Action Program got a new injection of money. Well, the money would have run out if it hadn't. So that was more of the same, actually not quite as much of the same, but on the same lines. And there was a tick-off for the Snowy Mountains hydro scheme, but that was announced by Malcolm Turnbull, and surely the story would have been if they hadn't ticked it off. So I don't think, myself, that there has been a significant modification of the climate program.
Now, just a couple of points. On trust, I mean, Michelle's point is dead right. I mean, the support of the two major parties used to be in the middle 90% in the late 40s. It's now in the 70s because there's been a consistent drift away from the major parties as the electorates basically increasingly lost confidence in the political system, in the politicians, in the process. And so some of the actions we're seeing now, which are quite tribal, are actually feeding that cynicism about politics. I mean, you can't tell me that Abbott running against Turnbull wasn't tribal. You know, you can say we're moving on from tribalism, we shouldn't have it. But they play the tribal dimension of issues, they play the personal dimension of issues. Politics has just become incredibly short-term, very opportunistic, sometimes populist, mostly negative, and quite often very personal. And in those circumstances, voters have pulled back. I think voters are looking for authenticity and they're looking for outcomes. They want to see that you're governing. Basically, I think most people think you put the government there to take the big decisions on the bigger issues that as individuals we can't take. We'd like to get on with our lives basically day in, day out. But the bigger issues that need to be, you know, longer term issues in particular, that's what you put the government there for. And when they're not doing that and they're letting them drift, I think it feeds it pretty badly. Just on climate, I mean, yes, I think it was to be seen. There was a bit of pressure from the progressives in the party just before that. You've got to be seen to be doing something about climate. So they just announced a whole lot of bits and pieces, some of them quite inconsistent, and some of them throwing away some of their arguments against the ALP. For example, on Snowy Hydro, they haven't defended that. They won't release the feasibility study. Brings back echoes of the national broadband network. We won't tell you that it's not feasible. And it is not, I don't believe it is. I don't think it's commercially viable. But then they announced a second link with Tasmania. Right? And the feasibility study for that says that unless you have an emissions target of about 45 or 50% by 2030, that is, you accelerate the closure of coal-fired power stations, which is the Labor Party position, you know, it's not viable. So there's all these inconsistencies in that sort of rush to let's announce a few things, let's extend the Abbott stuff, we'll build on Turnbull, I'll announce a couple of other things. But within that, all inconsistent messages, and none of them really a substantive response to the climate challenge.
I think one of the interesting things about the Morrison government is that it's all about announcements and doing things. And often, as you say, they're not particularly consistent. But this seemed to me to reach a peak quite early in the great strawberry affair. You know, you had the needles in the strawberries. Yeah. The company said they thought on the first couple of days that this was a disgruntled employee, which is exactly what it turned out to be. Mm. And we had this enormous kerfuffle in the parliament. Legislation rushed through in a couple of days as though, you know, there'd been some national emergency arising. Someone told me the other day, I don't know whether it's true, but at least it's a nice story, that they actually flew the legislation up in a plane to Darwin, where the Governor General was, so it could be signed quickly.
Wow.
I mean, it's just the whole thing was bizarre. And yet everybody treated this as though this was really quite normal.
Mm. Yeah, look, Scott Morrison's basically an advertising guy. And by that I mean he's got a pocket full of slogans. You ask him a question, he'll give you a slogan. He won't have necessarily taken it to Cabinet or talked to his colleagues. He'll answer the question. But don't ask him a second question for detail, because there isn't any. And you saw that in the Wentworth by-election. Issue after issue, he came out on a daily basis and had to have a position. The sales of the Sydney Opera House, the independence of the ABC,
Jerusalem.
Gay teachers, refugees, moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. All instantaneous sort of responses, all of them counterproductive in that campaign. Mm. So while it might have been a close contest to start with for Karen Phelps and Dave Sharma, in the end, he gave it away. And, of course, then there are no lessons from that. He says, oh, we didn't learn anything, it's a special seat, you know. She only won by 1,800 votes. She won by 1,800 votes on top of a 17.5% swing, nearly a 20% swing, which by historical standards is huge. I think there are a lot of lessons in there. But they don't want to learn those lessons, and they'll just go on with some more slogans and some more strawberry events, which, you know,
nothing
are designed
to strawberries, build
your confidence.
Sorry, nothing.
I think it's counterproductive. People don't get more confident by seeing that sort of barrage of stunts and soundbites.
Can I just add a footnote on the Wentworth by-election? I think this is going to be one of the really interesting contests to look at on election night, because next time round, those voters will not necessarily still be as angry about the whole Turnbull affair as they were last time. You've got two very strong candidates, Karen Phelps, the incumbent now, and Dave Sharma, the Liberal candidate, who's an impressive candidate. And I think that some Liberal voters will be thinking, well, OK, I gave them a knock last time, but who do I want to be there in 10 years' time? Who do I want to be an important member for this area, an area that you, of course, would know so well? And I think that that's just one seat. There are not many around, but one seat where it's possible the Liberals could get it back, because the Independent has not really, well known as she is and was before the by-election, has not yet had the sort of time to establish herself like, for example, Rebecca Sharkey or Cathy McGowan, who, of course, is leaving, but she did in the previous election.
John, it was your seat. What do you think will happen there?
Well, I actually predicted that they could lose that seat in the by-election. Before Karen stood, I said if somebody like Karen Phelps stood and she ran on the issue of not only disunity but climate change, and it was a referendum on climate change, she could win. And that's exactly what happened. I door-knocked in that seat during that campaign just to get a sense of the mood. Part of the pitch was, of course, you could vote for Karen to register a protest and you could change your mind at the May election and vote Liberal again. But I met a lot of very disenchanted Liberals who were very annoyed by what had happened. and we're finding it very difficult to actually accept the outcome of what had happened. So I think it is a contest. I think it's going to be very interesting. It's going to be, on paper, it's very hard for Keren to keep the seat, but I think she'll give it quite a go, and she's had a fair bit of publicity in a short space of time. I mean, it takes you a long time to get known in politics, and usually get known for the wrong things, but, quite easily get known for the wrong things. But she's there, and she's known, and she's active. So we'll see how it goes. I think it will be a contest, though, because I think there are a lot of disenchanted Liberals, and you'll see that in a number of other key seats where strong independents are going to challenge sitting members, and we'll see how it unfolds. I mean, but that could be the story in aggregate of the election campaign.
It's interesting, though, and it gets back to your point, Michelle, about trust. And, you know, but in the end, in the Australian system as it is at the moment, it is very difficult for an independent to get up anywhere. And, of course, we've got some well-known challenges in several seats. They're not all going to get up. None of them may. Tony Abbott's seat and Julian Burnside, of course, taking on Josh Frydenberg here in Kooyong and elsewhere. It is really hard for independents to win. The Greens, you know, they're around 10%. It looks like they're probably forever going to be around 10%. In the end, it goes back to those major parties. Where else do you think independents might surprise?
Well, I think the interesting contest, apart from Wentworth, there's Indi, and I think that there you've got an independent trying to give her legacy to another independent, and you'd think there might be a bit of a struggle to pass on that legacy.
I can't remember her name, the candidate. I remember Cathy McGowan's name.
Yes, and I'm struggling to remember her name. I think I do, but I won't chance it. But I think that in that case it'll depend on how strong the Liberal candidate is, and the Nats are running too, so it'll be hard. The interesting one, of course, is Tony Abbott's seat. Now, we at the University of Canberra actually did some focus groups on this a couple of weeks ago. We're going to do some more. And the message out of those focus groups was that people were disenchanted with Abbott for various reasons, but they hadn't really... Zadi Stegall hadn't really penetrated their consciousness at that point. Now, that was a while ago, and, of course, we've got weeks and weeks to go until the election. But I think that that'll be a red-hot contest, and you wouldn't want to be betting the house on that one either way.
No, I think there are about six major groups in that seat that have spoken to me about, you know, the wanting to get rid of him. Tony, in his own pre-selection, won against an empty chair by 4 votes. His own electorate conference didn't want him. And the local issue that really bites is the fact on the same-sex marriage vote, where true there was a protest vote, but about 75% voted yes. And Tony not only abstained, but walked out of the parliament. And that's gone down very badly. You're supposed to be representing us. It's not your view, it's our view. So
and that came through the focus groups too. It was interesting,
really,
even though
it's issue.
A couple of years.
So he's got a real fight on his hands, I think. And Zali's got to do a lot more to get known.
I'd like to see that particular seat fought out on the beach instead of the ballot box. I think you've got a former Olympian and a triathlete, and I actually think we could try something new.
No, the imagery is terrible. Budgies won't.
We are more than halfway through this discussion already, and no one has said Bill Shorten yet. So I just said it, I think, you know, if I was a member of the Labor Party, I'd probably just be thinking, go away, just go on a holiday for 2 months, lay low. And, of course, that is not how it works. He's got to be out there every minute of every day. John, You've been in an election where everybody thought the result was going to go a particular way and it can turn on a dime. What do you think would be going through Bill Shorten's mind and his campaign strategy?
In my case, I didn't actually think I'd win. So I was about the only one who didn't, it's true, but...
God, you're a good predictor, aren't you?
Yeah, very good. I think the Labor Party were really concerned at the time of the leadership change that Morrison wouldn't survive and in the last minute they'd switched to Julie Bishop.
It's too late now,
but that was a real concern of the Labor Party organisation. Senior people actually spoke to me about that. Now, that risk is gone. And I think basically what you said Bill's doing is keeping his head down. He's visible but not saying or doing very much, and that's his best chance of getting there. He's not, his net dissatisfaction rating is significant, so he's not liked, but neither is Morrison. So it's going to be the choice of the lesser of two evils, I think, in the eyes of many people. And it's hard to say, I think it's hard to say how that will cut. On the polling... The Labor Party could win 15 to 25 seats. There are some Liberal backbenchers that think they might end up with a number as low as 42. They've got, 73 now, and the Labor Party's got 69. They need 76 to win. It's hard to see them getting any more than maybe one seat in that sense, and a lot that they could lose. So it's sort of a foregone conclusion in the minds of a lot of people. But, then the campaign itself can be a real contest. It can make a difference depending on how people perform head-to-head, if you like, for the 4 weeks.
How do you think Bill Shorten's doing so far this year, Michelle?
Well, I think he's done well by default because of government problems and mistakes. I do think that... voters have serious reservations about him. Often they can't really articulate what those reservations are, but nevertheless, it's something that does concern Labor. Labor's confident, but getting so close to the end, always nervous. John says he didn't think he'd win that election. I thought he'd win that election. And so I've been very cautious ever since on predicting elections. But what can change? Well, campaigns can change things, and fear campaigns can change things. The so-called retirement tax, negative gearing, these sorts of things. Labor is somewhat vulnerable, there's no doubt about that. And when we think of campaigns changing things, not even going to the past, we see in New South Wales, for example, that you have expected the Premier to run a much better campaign than she has. Now, how much that'll cost her, we don't know. But nevertheless, things can happen in campaigns. Having said all that, with the numbers so close now, it's very hard to see how Labor could lose this. Famous last words, remembering 93.
It's like sort of watching Game of Thrones without the costumes. You know, the idea that Bill Shorten, who is probably more singularly responsible for the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd drama, which wasn't that long ago, now ruling with an air of such stability and poise, it defies belief.
Things move very fast these days.
Well, they do, don't they? And, are we in for a lengthy period of, one or two term rule with sort of fly-in, fly-out prime ministers? Do you think that could be where the culture is heading?
Well, that's a really interesting question. There are a couple of stabilising factors potentially. One is that both parties have changed their rules. So, in fact, a prime minister elected would, in the normal course of events, continue for the term. I mean, rules can be overthrown. But that stabiliser has been put in. I think if Labor had a reasonably strong majority, that would be another stabiliser. But some observers say, on the other hand, that the electorate is so disillusioned that if the polls go south after 6 months or a year, again, instability comes into the system. So there is that risk. But I think that it is more likely to, the situation's more likely to be stable than it has been in the last few years.
Oh, we're such optimists. That's, I'm not sure I feel it because I mean, they make
have
the rules
faith.
And then, yeah, I have faith. I want to get your reflections or observations on the Victorian state election and the upcoming New South Wales election on what might be interesting in relation to the federal campaign, John.
Well, I think the Victorian election had a lot of messages for the Federal Party and they didn't want to hear any of them. And I was particularly offended when Howard came out and dispensed with the outcome by saying, well, Victoria is basically the Massachusetts of Australia. It is about a third of Australia. And to say that, oh, they've just always been progressive down there, there were very real messages in that. I mean, if you look at it objectively, there are reasons why Andrews might not have done so well. I mean, a lot of chaos now in terms of roadworks, which he opposed to get in. And then you've had the red shirt issue and a number of other issues, which you could say would have been much closer. But he did deliver a very decisive win. And he has taken more aggressive positions on some issues like climate and so on. So, I mean, there are messages there. And I think to dispense with that by just sort of saying, oh, you know, it's the Massachusetts of Australia, was just an enormous oversight of the significance of the outcome. In New South Wales, you would have thought that Berejiklian government would easily be returned in the sense that, you know, she's created a budget surplus, she's paid off the debt, she's got infrastructure projects everywhere. And, you know, so on face value, you could argue she's done everything that they said they'd do. Although she hasn't opened anything, it hasn't cut too many ribbons, you know, and there's a fair bit of chaos in Sydney and other parts of the metropolitan area in particular. But she's quite vulnerable. I mean, she's only got a 6-seat margin. 4 of those are National Party seats, and I reckon they're on the nose. So she's really up against it to win. And then, of course, over and above that, you've got the issue about the stadium, which cuts, I think, electorally quite significantly. But not necessarily be a defining issue. So I think it's a bit closer than people think, even though I guess the polls are saying that now. They're saying basically line ball, but you would have thought she'd be doing better in the polls, would be in front. But I think people will look at... She's pretty straight, she's pretty honest, she makes mistakes, she's made a mistake. She works very, very hard. I think that there's a good argument there that she might just squeak back. It could go either way right now.
Do you think in terms of federal repercussions, people having a chance to take their baseball bats out first statewide helps
that.
The coalition federally?
It's still there. You know, and we don't know how much of that will have lingered into the state, but there will be some of that because there are a lot of disenfranchised Liberals who have just had enough of politics more broadly and the Liberal Party in particular, so... she's, you know, that is a big issue against her, but you don't know how significant it is.
I think one of the interesting things about New South Wales is the fact of these National Party seats, because the National Party seems to be in a shambles. Well, it is in a shambles federally, no qualification required. And if those seats go badly, then I think that the tensions federally will. Flare again. It's too late to change leaders, but there'll be a lot of angst running through the National Party. If the New South Wales government does badly again, I think that the federal coalition as a whole, the Liberals, will be in a state about that, and there'll be quite a lot of anger thrown around. So that'll be just before the announcement of the federal election. So that'll be a negative playing into the government side of politics. In Victoria, I have to say, even though, as you say, I've been in Canberra most of my adult life, I still regard myself as a Victorian. So
We regard you as a Victorian too, Michelle.
So I'm totally offended when the feds cast aspersions on Victoria. but I think that that the Federal Liberal Party probably doesn't understand Victoria very well. And, of course, after the Super Saturday results, we saw all this flurry about Queensland. And then that was countered by the Victorian results. So it does seem that there's going to be a bad result in this state for the government, no doubt about that. But I myself doubt that it'll be quite as bad as some people are saying.
Some people are saying maybe down to two seats.
I think that that's an exaggeration. I really think that it's hard to see that. For example, if you take Kooyong, that's been talked about a bit, I remember the Hawthorn result, but nevertheless, I think it is very hard to see Josh Frydenberg being tossed out of Kooyong. Mm. I think it'll be bad, but not two seats left.
I think the outcome of the federal election will turn mostly on Victoria and Western Australia. I think that the ALP is counting on at least five seats in Western Australia. And so although the focus was on Queensland and Dutton was going to be the saviour, I think it's going to be determined in Victoria and Western Australia mostly.
But Dutton will need saving, I think.
Dutton may have his seat.
That poses all sorts of interesting questions about leadership if the coalition is in opposition, because they could lose Dutton, they could lose Porter, really, who are they going to be left with? Frydenberg, on my theory that he won't lose, Morrison, and, of course, maybe Tony Abbott, maybe not.
And maybe, as you pointed out, that might be some of the thinking in Wentworth with Dave Sharma.
Yeah.
A bit early for him.
it's very, very difficult to read. Mm. I mean, in my experience in the Liberal Party, if the position's vacant, there'll be a lot of hands in the air. They'll all want to have a go at it. And this next echelon is sitting there. They've been waiting for some time. I think that you'll get four or five of them probably put their hand up. But it's not clear that any one of them has an edge.
If there were to be a change of government in May and Bill Shorten becomes Prime Minister, what sort of a government do you think it would be?
Well, I think that he would go for a fairly steady, cautious approach, an approach that implemented promises, because one of the messages from the past years is that if you don't do what you say, or if you do things that you gave no notice of, very bad things happen to you. Tony Abbott would be able to be give testimony on that. So I think promises would be important. I think the interesting question is the influence of the union movement and how that would be managed. Now, we saw in the 80s a very productive relationship between a government and the union movement, which enabled significant reforms to be made that wouldn't have otherwise been possible. But there's no accord and there's not that sort of relationship. But nevertheless, of course, Bill Shorten has very close ties to the union movement. His support has come from there. So how that plays out and whether the union influence would be positive or negative for the government's economic management and for its ability to bring in good reforms remains to be seen if there's a Labor government.
I fear that there will be more union influence than that they're prepared to admit. I mean, he's personally beholden to the unions to getting him there and keeping him there. But having said that, if you read some of the statements made by Sally McManus and others wanting to take the industrial legislation that they put in under Gillard and scrap it and go back to more collective bargaining, industry-wide bargaining, more compulsory unionism and so on, that would be an enormously retrograde step. And they will have learnt nothing from what happened in the Hawke-Keating era in terms of industrial relations. To go back that way, I mean, in the days where you'd sort of have a plumber in Tasmania and a plumber in the Pilbara paid the same hourly rate, irrespective of the circumstances, it didn't make any sense to go for that industry-wide bargaining. And that was one of the big things that was shed in the 80s, centralised wage determination, and we went more to workplace and industry-based assessment. So I think that would be a big downside. I'm not sure, though, that they'll actually deliver some of the other policies they say. I mean, house prices are falling. They're falling faster than they did in previous crashes in both Sydney and Melbourne. And so if you want to go and hit negative gearing in that context, whatever its direct effect is, it'll have a very bad psychological impact. And so some of those decisions, so some of those policies might be pulled back a bit or grandfathered a bit more or something. So I'm not sure that you can judge how he will govern. I think the best Labor leader in my memory has been Hawke, and it, because he was really chairman of the board, you know, he didn't get down to the day-to-day nitty-gritty of an issue, although he was on top of it in terms of, you know, in terms of the internal workings of the party. But he let the ministers run and do their job. He had a very good ministry, and of course, when they didn't perform, he could carpet them. And I think he was a very successful prime minister for that period. You know, if Shorten were to do that, I think he might have a pretty good run at it, and that will mean he'll take some of the rough edges off some of the things he's been saying. But the fact that he doesn't have that accord, that relationship, that Hawke got in on a deal and he delivered the deal and it was beneficial to the whole country, not just to some particular unions in that deal. In those circumstances, I think there's a lot to be learned from the way he ran the place. And very different when, of course, Keating arrived.
And personalities can be really important in these situations. And if you think of Bill Keelty and the relationship he had with Hawke and with Keating, and right at the beginning of the government, Crean was still in the union movement. And I think that sort of working relationship was critical. Now, Sally McManus is more radical than those people and is not as close in as they were. Just on your point on negative gearing, it's interesting that Labor hasn't yet, I don't think, given a start date, has it, for the negative gearing. So it does have some flexibility in that area to say, well, in the circumstances, we won't alter the policy, but we...
That's right. When they announced it, of course, the investor demand was very strong, and people were buying multiple residences and so on and gearing them all. And the world changed quite a lot because they've taken fairly decisive action against the investor community and including foreign investor community. So the circumstances in the market are very different. And instead of the market rocketing up, it is actually falling quite fast in Sydney and Melbourne, and some parts of it will be, I think, a bloodbath. Some of the unit areas are really... You've got a couple of 100,000 units coming on the market and the annual demand's about 60,000. You know, So you can see pressures really sitting there, and the authorities are behind the game in managing that. So it will be a very difficult set of circumstances to suddenly say, well, we'll do negative gearing, we'll cut the capital gains tax concession and so on. I think you might find that it might be phased... and may never be finished, that sort of thing. It's hard to know.
On a very different front, one interesting question will be what it does on the whole home affairs and security area. Shane Newman, the spokesman on immigration, is, to put it mildly, very low profile, and there's been a constant question mark about whether he'd get that job in government. I think that there have been indications they would keep home affairs, but it was interesting that the police association the other day said that they thought that the federal police should go back under the Attorney General's department and minister, and I think that ASIO must be feeling that it's probably... would be more comfortable elsewhere too. So what To say nothing of whether they keep Mike Pezzullo, the head of Home Affairs, formerly worked for Beazley, so has Labor connections, but nevertheless is seen as a very hardliner. On the other hand, they need to send messages to the people smugglers. So there are all those elements feeding into questions about the future of that department.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if they kept Home Affairs myself.
Might keep the name and just cut limbs
off.
Just reshuffle
the deck a bit. Yeah.
If you'd like to ask a question, please just put your hand up and if a microphone lands in it, start. Yep.
With the proposed changes to the franking credit, the shadow treasurer has quite conceitedly stated retirees vote against them if they don't like it. Now, with the coalition in disarray, what impact, if any, do you see this having on the outcome of the forthcoming election?
I don't think it will be as big an impact as people say it is, although it's hard to tell because the distribution or who's benefiting really from that original decision is still, to my mind, in the data quite unclear. If you look at the history of that decision, Howard and Costello were going to tax trusts, and in order to sweeten it, they said, let's give a cash refund on imputation credits for those who are on low taxable incomes. And they never did tax trusts, but they gave that benefit. And the initial cost estimate was about $500 million. It's now somewhere between $6 or $8 billion a year. It's a big number. And if you look at the distribution, there are some quite wealthy people that are getting the benefit of that simply because their taxable income is very low, not necessarily their total income. But so I don't know how it cuts in the electorate. I'm being honest. I really just don't know how that will cut. There's certainly been a movement among the retiree community to run hard against it, but whether it would be a defining issue in their vote, I don't know. And there are other reasons to vote against the Liberal Party, apart from the position that Shorten's taking on that.
I regard myself as an ordinary old bloke, but there are people in the federal parliament who consider that I'm a threat to our democracy. I am a member of GetUp, and I do contribute to issues that I think are important and warrant support. And I think that, I wonder, and I'd like to know, what you think about the influence of organisations like GetUp. If, for instance, they do vote Tony out, will that mean that...
Tony's gone.
A lot of other people might be looking in the mirror and saying, well, perhaps I shouldn't be so ideological and I should think more of the people that I represent.
I'm so glad it was GetUp, as we're live streaming for the first time and you stood up and said, a lot of people might think I'm a threat to democracy. My heart stopped for just a second.
There's no pause button?
Yeah, no, we got no pause.
Well, I think that there's an interesting point behind the influence or the rise of GetUp and such groups, and that is that now that people have become so disillusioned with the major parties and anyway are not joining parties, are just too busy or not interested or don't want to sit through the meetings or whatever, they are coalescing more around issues, and GetUp sort of reflects that deeper trend that that we're seeing. But as to people demonising GetUp, well, I think it's ridiculous to demonise issue-oriented groups and expressions of totally peaceful expressions of people's feelings about issues or things they want to promote. And I think that it's just a bit of, you know, political play, political propaganda to demonise such groups. If citizens want to give their money to a cause and a group that's going to advertise, going to promote the issues they believe in, well, that's part of democracy, a good part of democracy, I would think.
As much as putting money into booking the Sofitel 2 weeks in a row, you'd think, wouldn't you?
But you can see somebody like Tony Abbott blaming GetUp for losing the seat, where it might have had something to do with his position on same-sex marriage and on climate and key policy issues as well. And well, they don't want to face the reality of the fact that some of the issues on which the government has been running are not resonating at all with the electorate, not just the point I made about the cost of living, but, you know, trying to get a new coal-fired power station, which they've just ruled out this week. But for the government to do that when international banks won't fund it, when insurance companies won't insure it, you know, you're really playing a particular issue, trying to play an issue to your advantage. Now, GetUp can capitalise on that and run on the issue and make a point and win the argument. And so I think, you know, they're always very good at rationalising outcomes. As I said, there were no lessons in the Victorian state election. There were no lessons in Longman. There were no lessons in Wentworth, but there were. And, you know, you can't just go out and blame a GetUp for that, those outcomes, even though they may have played a significant part in those seats.
Would it be a lot easier for the Liberal Party should they lose if Tony Abbott does go as well?
I think there are a lot of people who'd like to see Tony Abbott go and not lose, the party not lose.
Yes.
But, you know, look, there'll be... Abbott won't be the victim of a big swing, like a national swing. He'll be a victim of a swing within that seat. And that'll be, I think, much more significant than the national swing, myself.
I think it would be easier in the sense that I do think that the Liberal Party has to move on to a new generation and resolve the internal tensions that we were talking about earlier. And I can't see that happening if Tony Abbott, well, certainly not if he was leader, and although I still find that very hard to believe that that would happen, frankly, but it's always possible. Anything's possible in politics these days, I have to say. But I think that even if he was in the party, it would be hard to sort of move beyond the past, and I think they really have to, and it's going to be quite a difficult process anyway.
His end game is to get back to the leadership. He's been prepared to destroy the standing of the government to do that already. You know, so in those terms, I think they're better off without him in government. He's had his run. Wasn't successful. Move on.
Can we go back to your earlier comments about the Greens, independents and other minorities, because looking back on elections, it seems to me that third parties generally do better when the electorate can't really decide, perhaps pissed off with all of them, but when there's a significant issue, it polarises people. You either go left or you go right. Where are we now? Because we've got a government that is determined to lose an election, but as you said, ALP is keeping very quiet and not really saying we're the alternative, except by default. So which way do you think the independents and the Greens and the other third parties will go?
Well, I think a couple of points. That the Greens, I suspect, may have peaked. I think that this could be quite a difficult election for the Greens. They've got a lot of their senators going out. They've had internal problems in New South Wales and Victoria. You just get the feeling that they're not connecting with an increased number of people. They're connecting with their loyalists but not expanding their base. With the independents, as the point has been made, the electoral system makes it very difficult for them in the lower house. I think people giving support to community independents, but the system is sort of working against them in the lower house. The Senate system also is going to be harder for minor parties this time round. It's the first Senate election after those changes that the Turnbull government made. Sorry, the first half Senate election. We've had a DD, but the first half Senate election. But we'll still have a good few of the miners around in the Senate. I agree with your point about polarisation, though, that you could well see even with these smaller parties getting, or smaller players getting some support, you could see quite a lot of polarisation. In other words, people could move quite strongly to throw out a government and go for the alternative.
I think independents can do quite well if both parties are on the nose, and they are. It's just a question of whether one's more so than the other. An independent's a great way of registering a protest vote, recognising that they'll never be in government. You know, and you look at Xenophon, for example, he was very influential for a fairly long period of time, simply with silly sound bites and stunts.
Senate, though.
Until it looked like he might win in South Australia, and then, of course, his vote collapsed. And I think you're getting a lot of that on the Greens. The Greens have been a mechanism by which you get a protest vote. They haven't been consistent, I think, in their application of Green policies. I mean, you look at the difficulties that Rudd had in getting his legislation through, and then Gillard had to, the deal she had to do to get a carbon price up. They're extreme views, and they haven't manifested in better government. And so I think they are struggling. That's not to say in some seats they won't do okay, but I do think that they are struggling. Their vote, as you said, I think is sort of crystallised at that, was it 8 to 10%, I suppose, now. And but other independents in particular seats could do well. An independent seat in Abbott's seat should do well. An independent now in Hunt's seat might do well. An independent in Dutton's seat might do well. It just depends how, in the end, who they are and how well they run. But they're a mechanism by which you'll get a protest vote. And there's so much disenchantment with both major parties that I still think there's a chance that you'll end up with more independents in the lower house. They would then be in a unique position to improve government. I mean, rather than if they just stood for good government and supported legislation that was in favour of good government, and they didn't support stunts and point scoring and so on, they could make a real difference in the lower house. And to some extent, they did that at the end of last year, but very early days in that.
How is it in the press gallery up there, Michelle, this time round? You've seen a lot of elections.
I think in the press gallery it's sort of getting to a state of exhaustion. The permanent campaign is really a feature of our modern democracy, and this campaign has been going on since the day after the last election. Bill Shorten, of course, was energised then. Anthony Albanese was quite disappointed, because he thought that the election might be not as good for Labor and he might have a crack at the leadership. That, of course, became impossible. But Shorten has been running hard ever since election day, town hall meetings, running around the country. But it's not just an opposition. It's also the government these days has been forced to be out on the campaign trail daily. Now, I think this is actually a bad development, because I think what it means is that if you have no respite between elections, then you just get worse government. And goodness knows what is being promised on a seat-by-seat basis, because the leaders are running around the seats throwing out dollars and cents everywhere to a lot of projects one suspects are pretty unworthy and unnecessary. So in all sorts of ways, I think that the permanent campaign is a negative, and it's certainly a shocker to live through.
Well, we are really tremendously grateful, Michelle, that we can enjoy the fruits of that shocking deal that you now have. You've seen so much change over the years you've covered these, but your wisdom just gets greater and greater. We're incredibly grateful you coming to Melbourne just for tonight. She's got to go straight back to the capital as soon as she can get there.
Section.
Yeah, right. And John as well, you've come down especially, and it's great to, you know, you give perspective. And I think in so much of what's about, there's very little of that. So we'll just keep eagerly reading everything you're writing in the conversation. Don't forget to look at the conversation. It's just great. And John as well, when you pop up, hopefully not after dark, before dark, here, there and wherever you may be. But please, a big round of applause. A thank you for our guests. Thank you so much.
John Hewson, Michelle Grattan and Sally Warhaft, recorded live at the Wheeler Centre on Tuesday, March 19th, 2019. Visit wheelercentre.com for more from the series, including a video of this conversation. When we return, we'll be talking about race, multiculturalism and the spread of hate and nationalist populism in Australia today. Until then, take care.